Okay, well, to start proceedings, we thought rather than sort of straight away pitching any of you still jet-lagged or still recovering from your flight into proceedings straight away, we'd actually start off with a panel where some of us do a bit more work. I'm not intending to do very much. I'm just simply here to chair matters, although apparently I'm allowed to intervene periodically. I have my instructions and wares about what I am not allowed to do. But what we thought we'd do is choose a topic, sort of some kind of theme that popped up at multiple points during the Cold War, but also had a degree of topical resonance. And so the idea of regime change seemed an obvious one to go for. So in this panel, we've got three commentators, two of whom at least have already been mentioned. Artemy Kalinowski, who was the organiser last time round and is now teaches at the University of Amsterdam, but is fortunately a frequent visitor still at the LSE, and who's an expert on Afghanistan and Soviet Central Asia and all sorts of exciting places which leave me utterly perplexed. But I'm always fascinated to learn more about from him. Then Salim, who I introduced earlier from the University of California, Santa Barbara, who's very bravely agreed to take part despite being jet-lagged, so all sort of allowances have to be made for the fact that goodness knows what time it is Californian, on a Californian clock by now, but he's an expert particularly on the Middle East, so has obvious input on this theme. And then further to my left, Vanni Pettina, former once of the LSE as well, as a visiting GTA and multiple other functions, but now where are you now, then?
Kluge Center.
Okay, thank you. But particularly a Latin American expert, so we'll bring in a Latin American dimension to our proceedings. So, without anything more from me, shall I hand it over straight? Did we agree on an order? Anybody particularly want to start or not want to start? Artemy, are you happy to go?
Sure.
Go first.
Go first.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Wes, for organizing it. I should say, in addition to thank you for saying, you know, that I set a high precedent, but I should also add that when I organized this, there were some long-lasting romantic relationships that emerged from the gathering, you know, on this kind of line of networking. No pressure on you, Wes. No pressure.
I didn't know you helped me in that.
Just something to throw out there. Wes asked me to be on this panel, I think, because of my PhD work on the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan. But I get kind of physically ill now when I have to talk about that again. So I went in a slightly different direction. I want to talk about regime change at home. Now, during the Cold War, generally, regime change undertaken by the two superpowers was usually in support of interests, ideological adherence, or to stop one-time clients from going over to the other side, either actively or through their loss of power. In some cases, Hungary in 1956, Czechoslovakia 68, Afghanistan 79, 80, this means resorting to actual intervention. Other cases, Iran 1953, for example, this involved covert operations. In almost all of these cases, domestic constituency was present to take advantage of the patrons' desire for regime change. If we exclude the establishment of communism in Eastern Europe at the beginning of the Cold War, we see, I think, that most actions towards regime change, at least the ones that I could come up with off the top of my head in the last 2 days, were generally conservative moves intended to preserve a regime or restore a recently overthrown regime rather than active. But these new regimes did not become puppets of their patron, an ever sort of grateful puppet being brought to power. On the contrary, they tend to develop, I think, policies that are quite independent of what their patron perhaps intended or what they would have been expected to do, right? Goulash communism in Hungary, perhaps one of the more well-known examples. The Shah's transformation of Iran into a regional power. Roham Alvandi will be here tomorrow. He's not here today to prove me wrong, and I'm going to state that that's the case. Or even, again, Afghanistan, which I just said I wouldn't talk about, but where Babrak Karmal was often able to do whatever he wanted once the Soviets brought him into power and often ignore Soviet advice, despite his very obvious insistence on Soviet aid, advisors, and the 100,000-strong 40th Army. Now, the point, I think, is not just that these new regimes find a way to negotiate independence from their patrons, but that when they come to power, the way they come to power creates the necessary conditions for them to pursue these independent courses while still resorting to maximum aid extraction from the superpower. Often, by the way, I think against the superpower's intentions, right? The idea is that this is somebody who's going to be able to stand on their own. Often, they end up, I think, pumping more resources of various kinds in to support them. In the context of the global Cold War, the superpower that undertook regime change had to make the newly installed regime legitimate, not just for the domestic audience, but of course for the international one as well. And this then has all sorts of interesting implications for development, evolution of political systems, and so forth. But what about regime change at home? Does the history of the Cold War give us any interesting patterns to look for if we examine internal Soviet political dynamics? I can think of at least two cases where they do. And not surprisingly, they relate to Central Asia. There are four kind of periods, four moments of major political change in Central Asia in the Soviet period. One, of course, is the establishment of Soviet power, right, in the 1920s. The second one is 1937. That one is kind of universal for the whole Soviet Union in terms of when it takes place, right, this complete shift of old cadres in place of new ones. More, I think, even important in the Central Asian case, because there, the difference between the people who are put in and the difference between the people who are kicked out, I think, is greater. I won't get into the details. And the one that's interesting me the most interesting to me right now, is what happens when Khrushchev comes to power and then begins replacing provincial and republican leaders that Stalin had put in with younger cadres more likely to be loyal to him. Now, Khrushchev had several reasons for undertaking these changes. Right? Some of this just has to do with promoting people who are better suited to develop his economic policies and de-Stalinization, but also to promote people who would become his own political backers for battles within the Politburo, Central Committee, and the party. Now, is this just cadre policy, or is there something that resembles actual regime change the way we've seen it in the other cases? Obviously, because I've been asked to speak here, I'm going to argue for the latter. There are compelling reasons, I think, to look at this as a regime change. I mean, consider the similarities, right? First, there's the break that's involved that's quite significant in terms of pre-Khrushchev and post-Khrushchev in terms of party practice, ideology, economics, and culture. And Khrushchev is trying to install people who could operate in a significantly different framework than what had come before. Second, and this kind of brings us back to the Cold War, really, is that it's related to managing the Soviet relations with the Third World in general. And here I think this is kind of speaking to the papers of Masha Kirasirova and Tim Noonan and their bigger projects. People like Tursunov Jabayev in Tajikistan, Sharof Rashidov, Nuruddin Mukhidinov were promoted in part, to help develop relations with the Third World, especially India, the Middle East. What was done in the republics was done in part to demonstrate the superiority of the Soviet model in a number of spheres. Cultural, including protection of traditional culture. This became particularly important again in the 50s. Economic development, so on and so forth. So a similar logic then begins to underlies the flow of development of investment to Central Asia in this period, as that which motivates the vast flow of aid to the clients I mentioned earlier, such as Afghanistan after the Soviet invasion, including the need for the new leadership to develop its own legitimacy. The quickest way to do this, in the Soviet mind, is by helping in the sphere of development. And that's why you have an enormous pumping of resources after Khrushchev comes to power, often ones that don't make a whole lot of economic sense, but can at least demonstrate what Soviet power is capable of. I won't get, again, into any of the details. And yes, some of this also is already happening before Khrushchev comes to power. But if you look at the scale of things, and you look at the motivations, it's very clear that there is a big change after Khrushchev. The political situation created by Khrushchev's combination of de-Stalinization, regionalization, and outreach to the Third World, i.e. involvement in decolonization, then gives the new republic leaders unprecedented opportunity for negotiation in terms of what they were going to get out of the leadership, defining the limits of central power within their republics and the volumes and kind of development aid provided. The second case that I started to think about comes from the end of the Cold War, when Gorbachev carries out another massive reshuffle of local and republic-level parties to get them in line with his own plans. That one arguably is ultimately less successful, but I won't get into it now because I do want to set a good precedent in terms of keeping to time. But two questions that I did think of that may be useful for some of you is, one is, did Soviet leaders learn lessons from what makes regime change work? How does a regime that's implanted then made to look legitimate? I mean, do they understand, you know, what makes their people in Central Asia look legitimate, and how does that translate to regimes installed elsewhere? And vice versa, right? Do they understand when they look at developing countries and the regimes there, do they kind of start to look at what they should be doing in Central Asia, or does it never occur to them to learn these kind of lessons? And the second is, how does the regime change then affect the patron? Here, I think this is more global, and maybe Bonnie will speak about this a bit as well. In both kind of American and Soviet cases, the involvement in regime change often leads to economic commitments, leads to different trade patterns, different patterns perhaps of cultural exchange, and of course in the U.S. case, often various political and cultural upheavals, even if they're often kind of delayed. That's it for me.
Okay. Some fascinating parallels with some of the things you were saying about sort of the way in which changed regimes then capture their patron, with situations in the Cold War where you haven't quite got to regimes change, but where you've just had massive superpower intervention to prevent regime change. So, for instance, the way in which quite a lot of work has been done to show how the way in which both the French and the Italian regimes early in the very early Cold War were able to use the threat of communism as a method for extracting large amounts of money from their superpower patron, and saying sort of, unless you support our government policies, even if you don't like them, we will fall from power and the communists will take our place, with a very effective weapon. So some real parallels to explore there. But Salim, should I hand over to you?
Yeah, well, thank you, Piers. And I want to start first by thanking you and Wes for the tremendously hard work that you've done to put this conference together. I organized the conference last year with the help of Henry Marr, a student of mine who is participating in this conference, hopefully will show up soon. And from that experience, I can attest to just how much work goes into these things. And so it's really, I'm really appreciative that they did the work this time, that it didn't fall on my shoulders. I also really want to congratulate all of you graduate student presenters who were selected. It's an extremely competitive process. Again, I know this from last year and from previous years in which I've been involved in these things. Usually several times the number of people who are actually selected apply. So, and many really fantastic proposals are turned away. So it's a real feather in your cap that you are here. And I'm sure you'll have a wonderful experience and we'll all learn a great deal from each other. Piers is right that I showed up on a plane not too long ago and didn't get much sleep. There's also, you know, the significant time difference between California and London, so I'm actually a little bit delirious. Maybe that will improve my presentation. I should also, in previous exchanges with Wes, I stressed that he really, you know, needed to lower expectations about this presentation. I really haven't, you know, had time to think this through at all. I'm just pulling this out of my hat. just some notes that I jotted on the plane. So, I will just plunge in nonetheless, and hopefully make some sort of sense. So, you know, I'll be talking about regime change in the Middle East. Now, obviously, this is a huge topic, so I'll be tackling a really tiny sliver of it, which is the role that the United States played in affecting regime change in the Middle East. And in particular, I'll be looking at the more sort of dramatic classic cases of forcible, coercive, or extra-constitutional regime change, essentially coups or attempted coups. Now, what I find when I think back on this is that in the Cold War era, the number of times in which the United States does this or attempts this is not really that great. It happens less frequently than you might expect, and certainly less frequently than many people in the Middle East have alleged over the years. And the reason this is the case, I'm arguing, is because there were some very powerful constraints on this kind of activity that the United States had to be cognizant of. And those constraints fell into three main categories. There were global constraints, which was the risk that overthrowing a particular regime could bring about conflict with the Soviet Union. There's the regional risk, which is that the likelihood, really, that a regime change or attempted regime change on the part of the United States, or in which the United States participates, would generate intense opposition in the region. And that could make life really difficult for the U.S. government, diplomats in the region, for American residents in the region. And so there was always that concern. And then there's the local constraints, namely the problem of how to make any regime change that you have engaged in stick on the ground, how to keep the regime that you've put in place in power, ensure its survival, ensure the stability of the local environment after you have effectuated this regime change. So as a result of these constraints, during the Cold War era, U.S.-backed coups were relatively infrequent. And also, and this sort of picks up a little bit on what Artemy was saying, they were typically modest in scope. That is to say, instead of seeking to overturn a regime entirely and just bring in a completely new set of people, typically it involved working with people who were figures who were already in place. Classically, of course, the military. Or in some cases, working to preserve or to strengthen a head of state, an established head of state who was facing challenge from other elements of his government. The most famous or perhaps infamous case of that, of course, would be the Anglo-U.S. Orchestrated coup against Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953 in Iran. But what that really, it was essentially a restorative move. The idea was to make sure that the Shah remained in power and that he was able to control the situation more fully than before, and that this nationalist regime that had come to power by constitutional means, Mossadegh had been voted in by the parliament, was removed, and the challenge that he was posing to the post-war global petroleum order was dealt with. That's a very classic case. Another example of what essentially the United States was attempting to do was to restore or strengthen an existing monarch took place in Jordan in 1957 when King Hussein faced a challenge from his parliament, which, again, actually, this is one of the few cases where you had a democratic election in an Arab country. Elections in 1956, late 1956, had produced a very strongly pro-Nasser cabinet in Jordan, which began challenging King Hussein in all sorts of ways. And in the spring of 1957, essentially what you have is a palace coup, where King Hussein makes a bid for the leadership of the Jordanian army, whose allegiance was not clear. He forcefully asserted himself in a way that caused the military to rally behind him, and then with the military under his clear control, he removed the cabinet, placed several of those members under house arrest, and this was strongly supported by the United States, and there were a number of gestures that the Eisenhower administration made to ensure that this succeeded, you know, moving the Sixth Fleet to the Eastern Mediterranean and making public statements in his defense and in King Hussein's defense, and essentially pledging American prestige behind this move, or staking U.S. prestige, I should say. Now, there is a difference between the two cases in the sense that there's a much higher degree of outside orchestration in the first case in Iran in 1953. But nonetheless, in 57, the support that the United States gave to Hussein really was crucial to his success, and he probably would not even have dared to move in that way had he not gotten support from the United States in the first place. So now what allowed these regime changes to succeed was the fact that the three constraints I just mentioned weren't really that prominent. So we start with the global constraints. Now, at first glance, you might think that in the case of Iran, the possibility of Soviet intervention was quite great. Iran is actually right on the border of the Soviet Union. In fact, though, it really wasn't such a great threat because although Mossadegh was clearly challenging the United States and Britain, he had not really gained the allegiance or the strong support of the Soviet Union, which at that time saw Mossadegh as a bourgeois nationalist who was not really worthy of support. Now, that attitude would change. Just a few years later, after the death of Stalin and with the emergence of Khrushchev, the Soviet Union began taking a much more supportive attitude toward non-communist nationalist regimes, seeing them as worthwhile recipients of support. But 53, we're just at the tail end of the Stalin era, when this tendency to dismiss the bona fides of non-communist nationalists, especially in the Middle East, is still quite strong. So there really wasn't much of a threat of Soviet intervention in that case. If you look at, and certainly in Jordan, there was not any real prospect of Soviet intervention. Particular constraint was not that pressing. Now, regional, again, in the case of Iran, there really wasn't much danger of that, because Mossadegh did have some support in the Middle East. There were figures throughout the region who admired him, but for one thing, I mean, he's not an Arab leader, so he's not able to tap into the reservoir of Arab nationalism, pan-Arab nationalism, which in any case is not really all that powerful just yet. It would be just a few years later, in the mid to late 1950s, that Nasserism becomes this very powerful force throughout the region. Sort of the earliness of this case, both from the standpoint of the Soviet threat and the threat of regional opposition, ensures that Iran is not going to be so much of a problem for the United States, and Britain too, for that matter. In the case of Jordan, there were some significant regional repercussions stemming from the fact that the United States had placed its support behind a pro-Western monarch who had ousted a pro-Nasser cabinet. There was a price to pay for that, but primarily that was paid elsewhere than in Jordan. And King Hussein was able to hang on. Now, as for the local threat, the fact that you've got an established monarch in each case who has the support of the military ensured that particular problem would be minimized, and once each leader had made his move, although in the case of Iran, it was more Kermit Roosevelt making his move in Iran, and the Shah coming back to reap the benefits of it. But in any case, after that had been accomplished, the threat that local forces would coalesce against the newly restored monarch, that threat was quite minimal. Now, I mentioned a moment ago that the regional costs of consolidating King Hussein's position did show up elsewhere in the region, and that brings us to a third case, which is a contrary example, in which the constraints that I mentioned were decisive. And in fact, the first and second constraints, the global and the regional, were so decisive that we didn't even get to find out how decisive the third constraint would have been. And that's the case of Syria, a bit later in that same year, in 1957, when what happens is the Eisenhower administration becomes convinced that this radical regime that is in place in Damascus is about to fall under Soviet domination. So what the administration first tries to do is to foment a coup within the Syrian army. that fails when the effort is exposed and the ringleaders are rounded up. So then the Eisenhower administration moves to Plan B, which is a regional approach, and it tries to get Syria's Arab neighbors, and in particular Jordan and Iraq, to mount an invasion of Syria, overthrow its government, and put in a more suitable regime. And this runs into all sorts of problems. First of all, both Jordan and Iraq refuse to have anything to do with this venture because the Syrian regime has the strong support of Nasser, the president of Egypt, and Nasser by this time has really established himself as an overwhelmingly powerful, just in terms of popularity and hegemony, and figure in the Arab world. And neither Jordan nor Iraq is in a position to go up against that very powerful Nasserist tide and be enlisted in this venture that the United States has proposed. And second, so there you have a very powerful regional constraint that comes to bear. There's also a global constraint because it turns out that the one Middle Eastern power that has an interest in intervening in Syria to overturn the regime is Turkey. So when Turkey starts making moves against Syria, the Soviet Union, in the person of Khrushchev, threatens to attack Turkey. And all of a sudden, what was supposed to be this nice little cozy coup in Damascus turns into this global crisis in which the possibility of actual warfare between the United States and the Soviet Union is looming. And in that context, the Eisenhower administration comes to its senses and urges restraint on Turkey, and the crisis comes to an end. So there you see a case in which the global and regional constraints are so powerful that we never really find out what we don't know what would have happened had the effort gone forward. We don't know what sort of local constraints might have materialized. So now these experiences suggested that U.S.-backed coups could work only under very special conditions, which usually did not prevail during the Cold War era. Now, as you get to the closing decade of the Cold War, and definitely into the post-Cold War period, these constraints start to minimize and to diminish. Certainly, I would argue that the global constraint, well before the end of the Cold War, becomes less pressing. I have argued elsewhere that I essentially see the U.S.-Soviet rivalry in the Middle East as having come to an end almost a decade before the Soviet Union itself disappeared, essentially with a Soviet defeat. The ability of the Soviet Union to influence events in the Middle East is really, really minimized and diminished by the early 1980s. So that particular possibility that a U.S. intervention or an attempt to overthrow a regime would result in conflict with the Soviet Union is severely reduced. Also, the regional threat becomes less pressing. Arab nationalism is definitely in severe decline by the end of the 1970s. Even just more minimal forms of pan-Arab solidarity are very hard to muster and to bring to fruition by the early 1980s. And so that constraint is minimized as well. And it's in that context that you see, starting in the early 1980s, a greater tendency on the part of the United States to intervene in the region. But what you find, though, even in that circumstance, is that what's essentially what the United States is doing is engaging in punitive actions against rogue states or non-state actors, not really engaging in regime change in any significant respect. And this pattern, I would argue, continues into the post-Cold War era after the Soviet Union ceases to be. Now, of course, there's one huge exception to this rule. Well, I'll say one in the case of Iraq in 2003. You could also say, if you include Afghanistan as being part of the Middle East, you could say two exceptions. But certainly Iraq is a very striking one in which the United States moves in to overturn a regime without, and it's not this more modest conception that I talked about earlier, where you try to find figures within the regime that you prop up and support them against their local rivals. In this case, it was an attempt, and you know, a successful attempt, at least in its narrow definition, to remove the regime entirely and eradicate its base of support and bring in an entirely new regime. Now, obviously, the pitfalls of approaching things in that way have been so glaringly obvious that since that time, those instances in which the United States continues to engage in regime change or to contemplate regime change fall back into that classic pattern of trying to work with figures already there rather than trying to remove a regime in its entirety and start entirely from scratch. So that's all I got. I'll stop here, and we'll welcome any further discussion that you may have. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. If that's what you'd like when jet-lagged, we sort of thank God for the rest of us that you are jet-lagged. But okay, Vanni, can I move straight over to you? Change of consonants, change of regions, so I suspect a bit of a Latin American twist to what you're going to tell us.
First of all, let me thank you, Ideas. Let me thank you, you, Beers. Let me thank you, Wes. I've been here for more or less 2 years in the past, and being here is always like being at home again, so it was a wonderful experience. So I'm basically here to hear and to comment on your papers, but I mean, I'm sorry, but this time you will have to hear me say what I have to say about regime change in Latin America. Of course, I'm going to give a very general presentation, but that I hope will give you some elements for a broader reflection on regime change in Latin America during the Cold War earlier, and to give us some element to think also about the present. I'm going to focus on Washington attempts to influence the evolution of Cuban political process and regime change process in two particular occasions, the 1933 revolution and the 1961 insurrection. Why I think this might be interesting and important. I think that Washington attitude toward these two Cuban domestic political crises were incredibly different in terms of strategy, in terms of attitude, in terms of results. And since the historiographical debate on USA and Latin America has been pretty monopolized by what we could say a revisionist approach that tend to underline the continuity of the USA foreign policy toward Latin America, these two cases are very important because they highlight quite the opposite, the discontinuities of Washington attitudes toward Latin America and Cuban, in this case, process of political change. And also because perhaps they will give us a framework to better understand what is going on in this moment and which might be Washington attitude toward the current process of political change and regime change, perhaps starting in Cuba a few months ago with the last extraordinary Congress of the Communist Party, which introduced important reforms. During the 1930 revolution, to be very short, Washington firmly avoided any kind of military intervention. It sided with the most representative and some of the most radical forces that were struggling against, in this case, Gerardo Machado dictatorship, and in the end clearly contributed to the fall of Machado dictatorship, and on the long term it also substantially helped the consolidation of a democratic process in Cuba that was crowned in 1940 with approval of a new, very advanced constitution. That we can only compare to the 1917 Mexican Constitution. By contrast, between 1956 and 1961, Washington avoided any kind of open dialogue with any kind of opposition forces to Batista. And particularly, as we know, it directly opposed one of the most representative actor of the opposition to Batista, which was Fidel Castro, 27th of July, of July movement. So how can we explain these two radical approach to Cuban, to this two Cuban, let's say, crisis, and how can we explain such a different result? In one case we have a democratization process, in one case we have a support for a dictatorship, and then, as we know, a radicalization of the Cuban political scenario that led to Castro revolution. Well, of course, there are many reasons. When I thought about this paper, which of course is based on my research, I wanted to give a detailed short list and of these reasons. Of course, for reason of time, I will just try to focus on one general that we can all perhaps understand if we are not expert of the Cuban case. I would focus on what Isaac Berlin would call like long-term historical movements that were taking place at the international level during this period of time between 1933 and I would say 1992. So I think we can delineate the presence of two long-term historical cycle of movements or movements. The disarticulation of the European world system of order between at least 1914 and the end of World War II, in what Paolo Viola called the European suicide. And the second long-term cycle would be, of course, the Cold War and its rapid globalization between the end, during the last year of the Truman administration, of course, during the first years of the Eisenhower administration. So how these two long-term historical movements did affect Washington foreign policy toward Latin America and also towards Cuba, determining that such different results that I've mentioned. Well, let's start with the first cycle. Of course, the disarticulation of the European world system of order vastly increased the entropy of the international system. This, of course, reached its climax during the early 1930s with the emergence of totalitarianism all around many countries of Europe, of course, Italy, Germany, and also with the beginning of a Japanese expansionist strategy in foreign policy in Asia. This process, from the American point of view, made very difficult to address the global governance in terms of economy, but in terms also of security through a transatlantic channel, and forced the FDR administration to put Latin America at the center of its new global strategy. But what was the problem? That to do that, to create a new hemispherical partnership, Washington had to quickly change a very bad reputation created during two decades of big stick diplomacy and dollar diplomacy. That meant, of course, avoiding any kind of military intervention in the continent. It meant to have much more attention towards the economic and social problems of the continent. And thirdly, it meant to build a new hemispherical foreign policy based on consensus, on intra-American consensus. And in Cuba, we can see all these elements brought on a small scale. So during the handling of the Cuban crisis, the highest center of power of the FDR administration were involved in the management of the crisis. The very same president, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Treasury, and even the Undersecretary for Latin America was sent by Roosevelt as his special envoy, which is quite a signal of the importance that was assigned to Cuba in that time. As I have said, Washington was forced to find an alternative to the Machado dictatorship, which might be quite consensual in terms of Cuban domestic domestic policy, and this of course brought Sumner Welles, Roosevelt. to open a dialogue with a Cuban opposition forces too much, or even if they were quite radical, as many groups at the time, of course, were. And so, I mean, these global constraints, perhaps we can say, created this sort of result. The beginning of the Cold War changes completely this scenario, and especially, as I've said, its globalization. What mainly affects Washington foreign policy toward Latin America, I would say, in first instance, is the Asiatization of the USA foreign policy, at least during the early 1950s. What happens is that the urgency to address the problem created by the colonization and its intertwining with the, let's say, Soviet threat in the region made Latin America much less important for the U.S. administration, which in turn meant that there was much less interest and pressure to pursue that kind of policy that had been implemented during the Roosevelt years and part of the Truman administration. So, if during the 1930s, so in the 1950s we can see again all these elements in taking place also in Cuba. So, there is a clear tendency by the USA policymakers and diplomats to stick to Batista dictatorship. There is no attempt to try a sort of legitimate alternative. Another signal of this of the impact of this long-term historical movement on the local scenario is that neither the president nor the secretary of state really are involved in the handling of the Cuban crisis between 1956 and 1961. Indeed, only low ranks State Department officials are dealing with the crisis, and even more curiously, in Cuba we have two consecutive businessmen as diplomats with no knowledge of Spanish language, with no any knowledge of diplomacy, which I think is a signal of how low was the importance of at least of Cuba in this occasion, and. And without like a global, like a broader framework, these diplomats are just sticking to Batista. The second element, and here I'm going to perhaps to touch what Salim also said, is that of course Washington not only avoids any kind of dialogue with Castro, but clearly opposes his movement, even if his movement is not communist, is not at that time particularly radical. But I think the problem again of nationalism is decisive in this occasion. During the 1950s, the Cold War started to assume this particular shape, configuration as a struggle between model of modernization. And as we know, Khrushchev skillfully used the advantage that at this point the Soviet Union seems to have in terms of development model, and as our administration start to find very difficult to interact with these non-communist nationalist movements, it start to be difficult in Asia, it start to be difficult in the Middle East, start to be difficult also in Latin America, where Castro is immediately associated to this kind of tricky nationalism. And so here we get the second point. It's very hard to establish some kind of dialogue with Castro, which, by the way, is the most representative opposition force to Batista. Another factor that pushed the Eisenhower administration to support the Batista dictatorship rather than trying to figure out a different solution. So now, this is open to the audience. What can we say about the present using these references that I gave, this point of reference? I would say, and for historians, it's always very hard to deal with the present, but I would say that we are seeing the configuration of a new long-term historical movement, which would be perhaps marked by a chaotic multipolarism, that that might push Washington to a pre-Cold War attitude toward Latin America, especially because it is becoming more and more difficult to address with the European partners any kind of a global governance. And on the other hand, we have the strong emergence of Asian actors that might push Washington to reconsider its foreign policy toward Latin America to create a new sort of partnership. I think we have some signals already. If you followed the what happened after why FB was nationalized, the Spanish oil company, Spaniards were absolutely outraged by Washington's lack of support. Washington was very, 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 very. Washington's response was very weak, and we are talking of a partner who has soldiers in Afghanistan, and who is helping Washington on the global scenario. But in spite of that, there was no much support from Washington. So this scenario might bring Washington to be able to reconsider its relationship with Latin America, but also with Cuba. It might be a good moment. Why not? I mean, again, if you have to represent yourself to your Latin American partner, you will have for sure to fix the Cuban problem. And so that's my.
Thank you. Well, it's always brave of any historian to venture into the present. The past is more predictable. but it was great, Vanni, to hear you doing so, but also to bring in the 1930s. I was pleased to see that one or two of the papers that have been submitted to this conference bring in some quite interesting long-term continuities going back before the Second World War. And it's good to have those introduced straight away at this stage of proceedings. What I'd suggest doing now is we've got about we can take up to 3/4 of an hour or so, but for discussion we don't necessarily have to take all of that time. But to try and encourage you to sort of straight away get into the spirit of this occasion, which is to really make you feel that you can all intervene, you can all pose questions, you can all put forward your own ideas. I'll perhaps start the ball rolling with one of my own, but I don't want this to be a kind of just the four of us up here talking amongst ourselves. I really want to throw this open as quickly as I can. So I'll give you a moment. I'll ask a first question simply to give you the time to think of some of your own. But if at all possible, I want to try and get straight away into the spirit of this conference and get this to be a real round table rather than a top-down event. But I suppose the question that I would start with is this, which both, in a sense, speaks more, I suspect, to Vanni and Salim's presentations than it does to Artemi, but by all means come in if you can, is the issue of regime change and democracy. So how much more difficult is it to carry out a regime change if you are working in a system, as you are implying was the case in 1930s Latin America, and is arguably the case more recently in a post-Cold War environment, where the end result, in order to be internationally defensible, has to be a democratic regime, rather than what was acceptable in the Cold War context, namely a regime that was not democratic? So how much is that a complicating factor? Because it does strike me that one of the reasons you could make a case that the Cold War is a conducive environment for regime change, despite all of the restraints and constraints that Salim was enumerating, is that it is a system where it is a period where both of the superpowers feel it acceptable to create regimes that are not democratically legitimate. Whereas since the Second World War, that has been arguably somewhat harder to do. Or am I simplifying too much? Since the end of the Cold War, Second World War. Yeah. I'm not jet lagged, but clearly the time zone difference from Devon is too much. is the democratic factor one to think about?
I think that's a very good point. And the way I would put it is that you could almost see it as something that is working in tandem with the local factors, the local constraints that make attempting a regime change today such a daunting prospect. And that is basically the way you could put it is that the confluence of domestic or local factors with a broader international, with broader international expectations. And namely, you know, in the last 20 years or so, there is this expectation that whatever results from an attempted regime change should have some democratic elements to it and should be defensible on the grounds of democratic theory. So I think what is happening, I mean, one of the factors that always has to be uppermost in policymakers' minds is if there is a regime that we determine simply has to go, and if we're able to put something in its place, it really does have to be at least have the appearance of being a move in the direction of democracy. And if you can't get the local situation to align itself in a way that fulfills that, then you have a big problem. So yeah, I appreciate the question, and it allows me to make a further refinement of my argument, which is that it's not simply the local constraints that remain, it's that the local constraints are there and they have now been supplemented by a new set of global constraints that did not exist in the Cold War era.
Okay, Ben?
When I thought about this presentation, another of the factor that I would have liked to mention, and that influenced Washington, the different approach between 1930 and during the Cold War, were of course the local factor. We have the international level, but then it has always to be approached, taken into account also what's going on in this case in Cuba and in Latin America. So I would say that in the present, taking into account also the local factor, it might be even easier to push for democratization in Cuba and in many other Latin American countries. Because this is a local autonomous process that has started in Latin America by the end, at least, of the 1980s. There is a clear process of democratization. And I think that might be a natural alternative also in the Cuban cases. And from the Washington point of view, it would be just a matter of find the tools to accompany, to follow, to push a little in that direction. So there are some of the conditions that might get the job a little easier in this circumstance.
Okay, so you'd be going with the grain rather than going against it by pushing for democracy? Possibly.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was just going to say, I mean, from my point of view, actually, the Cold War makes the necessity of making these regimes at least look democratic, and I mean, first of all, the internal ones, actually much greater. When you look at the internal kind of documents about, you know, selecting, you know, who's going to be promoted to first secretary and so on and so forth, what's striking one is, of course, there's different kind of levels of democracy. There's party democracy, and here they actually do take it quite seriously, right? Who actually has, within the local party organization, who has authority? Who's going to be treated as a legitimate leader? You can't just promote anybody. Mm-hmm. And there are kind of debates, and they often, interestingly enough, they seem to come down on who's also able to present this to the world. This is the internal Uzbek or Tajik party organization, not Moscow, who's having these debates. Mm-hmm. Who's going to present our face to the world? And that becomes important. And so you have this kind of double constituency that you have for this leader, I think, becomes important. Actually, again, it's not going to be democracy the way the United States views democracy, but it is going to be more democratic, certainly, than what comes before, and it has to look more democratic. And then the Afghan case, they are at least trying to, within the party framework, find somebody who is going to have much broader support, somebody who could at least be in power without the intervention. And then the whole kind of process after the intervention is making that person somebody who'd be elected even without the Soviet military presence there. Now, whether they actually get there is arguable. They come close. But anyway, that's the goal. Again, for a double constituency, the Afghan one and the international one.
Okay, great.